Thanks, Cheryl. Nice to be here. And as I let Regina and Cheryl know, this is actually going to be my last satsang, at least for a while. I'm going to be traveling, and I just decided this is a good time to take a break. And given that this is the last one of these hourly gatherings that I'm going to be doing, I have in mind a specific topic that I'd like to explore or like to speak about. It's something that I've been meaning to talk about on here for quite a while, and just haven't gotten to it. So if you do have questions that you came to this satsang with, just hold on to them. Hopefully, maybe there'll be a little time at the end, or you can always email me the question. If it's a simple question, I'll answer an email. And if it's a more complicated question, I might suggest that you have a one-on-one spiritual mentoring session with me, which is something I offer on my website, which is endless-satsang.com. So the topic that I would like to speak about is something that, in my sense of things, it's a very key and important piece of the spiritual puzzle. And yet it's one that doesn't actually get addressed in a lot of spiritual traditions. And that's the role of the superego. And the superego, very simply, is that critical or judgmental voice in our head. It's the voice that says, what's the matter with you? Or why can't you do anything right? Or how can you be so stupid? And we all have one. It's a normal, natural, actually healthy development when we're very young. This capacity to have that voice, or it can be a mental image that forms. And very simply, the role, the positive role that the superego, the inner critic or inner judge, the positive role that it has when it forms, and again, this is very early in life, within the first couple of years of life, when it first forms, its purpose is that it gives us a sense of mom and dad being present, even when they're not there, even when they're not within our view. And as a result, we tend to behave as if our mom and dad are present, even when they're not around. And, you know, for a very, very young child, that's a very useful psychic structure, a very useful psychological structure that keeps us behaving better, which generally, serves us when we're very young. To get along with the parents, with your parents, is a positive thing when you're completely dependent on them for food and shelter. However, this capacity to have this inner voice or picture or felt sense of someone that is critical, judgmental, controlling, in charge, kind of outlives its usefulness. And so most of us end up in adulthood even with an internal voice, an internal critic, an internal judge that attacks us, undermines us, makes us feel very small, very young. And we don't really need that when we've grown up. And by the way, this whole perspective that I'm sharing about the superego, it's not something I came up with. It's something I first encountered in the Diamond Approach, which is a body of teaching created by an author named A.H. Almas, A-L-M-A-A-S. And I was a student of the Diamond Approach for about 10 years, and this piece of work involving the superego was a very powerful and central part of what they share, as the Diamond Approach is a kind of blending of spiritual perspectives and deep psychological perspectives. And so I found it very useful. I should also mention there is a book. If anything that I'm saying here today kind of resonates, there is a book available like on Amazon. The title is Soul Without Shame. all without shame. And that is that's an entire book about the superego and about the process that I'm going to talk about as to how you can best counteract and deal with the superego. Because again, this inner voice, this inner image, tends to undermine us, tends to keep us in a less resourceful state, a very contracted state. And by the way, it's not. It may still have the voice and the visual appearance of your parents, but it also kind of incorporates as you get older. It incorporates all of the authority figures in your life. So, school teachers, bosses, police. Even spiritual teachers, a lot of people have a spiritual superego, a spiritual inner critic that criticizes you for not being spiritual enough. And the main key, one more time on the title, yes, I'll type it in, how's that? It's Soul Without Shame. And one of the key signs that the superego is active is if you feel small or inadequate or unworthy. It kind of re-triggers our sense of ourself when we were very small, when the superego formed. So when there's this inner voice or inner image judging us, looking at us as if we're worthless, it triggers that sense of literal smallness. Makes us feel like a young child again, and thereby, inadequate or worthy or incapable. And then another really key sign that the superego is active is when there's a voice inside your head referring to you in the third person. So when there's a voice in your head that says, "What's the matter with you? Why can't you do anything right? How can you be so stupid?" It's a voice in your head referring to you as you, which if you stop and consider for a moment, it doesn't really make sense. Who is calling who? You. And so that's again a key sign that the superego is active. So anytime you hear that voice talking to you as if you're another person, then you can be pretty sure that something like the superego is active. And this, it's like a split-off image. It's like an image that we formed, again, very early, but now it incorporates people from our lives, throughout our lives. But it's a split-off image of others criticizing us, judging us. And it's a very right place for a projection. And specifically, what usually gets projected onto the superego is our own strength, our own power, and discrimination. So we feel small, weak, incapable, not able to really decide. And we project onto this mental image, onto an image in your own head, those qualities of strength and power. And so it's this, again, this split-off image. Now here's the key thing. If you don't remember anything else I said about the superego today, but you just remember what I'm about to share now, and that is what to do when the superego is active. So this is the key point here. The best approach to the superego is to tell it to shut up. This is very surprising. And by the way, when you tell it to shut up, you mean it. You don't just kind of ask, "Could you please shut up?" No, you tell it to shut up. And if that doesn't work, you tell it to shut the hell up. And if that doesn't even work, you just escalate. You do whatever it takes to get the voice to leave you alone, to get that or that inner image or felt sense. Some people are more kinesthetic, some people are more visual, some people are more auditory. But often there's a little bit of all of those in there. There will be a felt sense of like someone big standing over you, telling you what an idiot you are and how you can't do anything right. And so you turn towards that felt sense or that image or that voice, and you tell it, you do whatever it takes to get it to leave you alone. Don't let it get a word in edgewise. Make fun of it, laugh at it. That's actually a really wonderful way to kind of make it into the butt of the joke. Turn the tables on it. Tell it that it's stupid. Tell it that it doesn't know what it's talking about. Tell it to go jump in a lake. This might be a stretch for some people, but I would even sometimes grab it by the throat until it shut up, because I just would like to stress that it is just an image in your own mind. It's like a cartoon character that your own mind has created. And so even if you are very tough with it, there isn't actually anyone there. There's no one actually gets hurt. In fact, I don't recommend that you take this approach with the actual authority figures that you encounter in life. You know, it usually doesn't work out so well to tell the policeman that's just pulled you over for speeding to tell him to shut the hell up and go jump in a lake, and that doesn't usually end up so well. And even if your parents are alive, you know, you don't necessarily need to be this tough with them, unless there's a real lack of boundaries or mistreatment by your parents. But this voice in your head, this image in your own mind, it's not a person. There's no one there that's going to get hurt if you, if you're tough with it. If you really turn the tables, in a sense, you defend yourself by becoming the judge, the critic, the powerful one. I literally sometimes have even used flamethrowers and bombs to get my superhero to shut up, because it's all a cartoon going on in my own head. And so I feel free. It's actually kind of fun. You can be like a samurai warrior with a sword and do whatever it takes to get the superego to stop. And if you can actually get the superego, that voice, to stop, it collapses the projection. I said that if you project your strength and power onto the, like Coyote and Roadrunner, someone typed in, how the Roadrunner always would set off bombs and stuff. Cartoon characters can get blown up over and over again. You find your superego. That is actually just like the Coyote in the Roadrunner cartoon. The superego does reconstitute itself, and so sometimes you have to pull out the heavy artillery again to knock it back down. But as I was saying, when you are successful, when the superego actually becomes silent, when it actually dissolves, then all of the strength and power that was being projected onto that critical voice inside your own head will actually flow back into your body and being. And then, you know, when you're filled with strength and power, you can decide what is true and what you need to do and what you did right and what you did wrong. You can be the one that discriminates what's really true in the situation without having an inner judgmental voice undermining you and making you feel inadequate. So paradoxically, when we defend ourselves against the superego, when we turn the tables in this way, we are actually embracing the energy of it, by reclaiming it for our own. So, you know, this approach to the superego, and it's like the exception that proves the rule, you know, most spiritual practices are really all about embracing, allowing, making space for things, letting things be the way they are. And that's a really good general rule, and yet here is this exception, that the way you embrace the energetic quality of the superego, of that inner judge inside your head, is by defending against it, is by becoming it, really, turning the tables on it, collapsing that projection, so that the energy comes back into you, and then you embrace that sense of strength and power. You can actually feel your sense of self get much bigger when you successfully stop the superego. And so, like I said, this is the exception that proves the rule. I don't recommend it for other aspects of your being. You especially don't want to yell at or attack the wounded, scared, limited feeling part of yourself. It's really just this inner judge or critic that attacks you. And by the way, I'll just mention, this is kind of a strange variation on this, but some people actually have a superego that is full of praise and compliment, because that was actually how their parents kind of manipulated them. That's how their parents controlled them, is by showering them with almost excessive praise whenever they did something right or did what the parent wanted. And so you might want to, you know, just also keep a little bit of an eye out for any time, again, there's a voice in your head referring to you in the third person. So in this case, it would be saying, oh, aren't you wonderful? Aren't you just the smartest person? Oh, you did that so well. Again, that third person, it's calling you, when it's really yourself. And, you know, it's really I or me. So that's, and paradoxically, that's also a time to tell it to shut up, tell it to leave you alone and mean it. Now this whole dynamic of this mental image of a superego, of this inner critic, is that one example, and of a more general principle that is in kind of depth psychology. It's called object relations. And the basic concept, by the way, the depth psychology, one of the great strengths of it is that it has studied in great insight and great detail the process by which our ego forms. So it actually, there's all this understanding of what, how and the ego forms, why the ego forms. And basically the ego forms when we start to form these mental images of others. And of course at first that's usually mom or dad, whoever is present. We form a mental image of them, which again is a useful thing when you're very young. It gives you this sense that they're still there, they're still present, and also still watching you when you're very young, even if they've stepped out of the room. So that's usually the first object relation that forms, is the one with mom or dad or whoever is your caretaker very early in life. And in order to hold a mental image of the other, initially, you know, the parent usually, but any other, this actually holds true throughout life. Anytime you're thinking about someone else, you're forming a mental image of them. And if you're hearing their voice, that's like a mental image. It's an auditory image, but it's a mental image of a voice. So anytime you're forming this mental image of other, in order to hold that image, in order for that to have a context, in order for that to make sense, you also form a mental image of yourself. And that mental image of yourself is the ego. So in a sense, when the superego first starts forming in our very early life, that's also when the ego starts forming. Because that's when we start to be able to have a sense of a self, a sense of a me. And we form that mental image of me in order for it to relate to and understand the mental image of mom or dad. And so, you know, we kind of end up living in this mental virtual reality of our image of ourselves, our ego, and our image of others, which also appear in the mind. In fact, you can think of them as almost like two ends of one stick. Anytime you're holding a mental image of something other than yourself, you also actually are forming a mental image of yourself. You also, the ego is also active. And in particular, when the superego is active, then again, there's this mental image of yourself, an ego image, that is, again, very small, feels very unworthy, inadequate, lacking, incomplete, not good enough. So these two ends of the one stick, they form together. And this is a very key point as to how this all relates to the spiritual journey. Because any time you actually turn the tables on the superego, effectively, anytime you successfully get it to shut up, get it to dissolve, get it to leave you alone, what also dissolves in that moment is the ego. When there isn't a mental image of other, when you actually turn it off by defending against it, by not allowing it to get a word in edgewise until it falls silent, when the superego falls away, the ego falls away also. Can almost be a little bit shockingly quiet, shockingly a sense of being alone in a way that you may not be familiar with. And yet it is the ego that has also stopped in that moment. Now, one of the reasons that people sometimes back away from, I just noticed somebody type in STFU. Yes, you can use language like that with the superego. But sometimes the reason people back away, there's a lot of psychodynamics in all this, because in a sense you're saying STFU to your parents, which is, I once described this process to a woman who was from Japan. And she just could not wrap her mind around being that confronted with her, again, even with her own mental image of her parents. Even though I stressed that I was not saying that she should be so direct or confronted with her actual parents, she just culturally found it really, really difficult to consider actually attacking the mental picture in her mind of her parents. But when you do, and this ego falls away, it gets very quiet, and there's a deep sense of aloneness. What actually remains, when both the superego and the ego have fallen silent, what remains is your authentic self, including, as I actually spoke about in one of the earlier satsangs, including an authentic sense of your individuality. It's just your authentic individuality and your authentic beingness. That's what remains when the ego false happening when the ego dissolves. However, that's a very unfamiliar state because it's in a sense so alone. If there is no mental image of others present in your brain, it's in a kind of aloneness that you have never experienced before. And very specifically, this is where some of the psychodynamics come in, very specifically, it might be like one of the first times in your life that you experience what it's like to be here without mom and dad. If all your life you've had this little, it's something like the angel and the devil sitting on your shoulders in the cartoon. You've had this inner voice, this inner presence that's always commenting on how you're doing and whether you're doing things right or wrong, always critiquing you. One of the positive effects of that, and I say positive because it's very positive when you're young and when you literally are dependent on your parents. One of the positive effects of that inner mental image is that it gives you a sense that mom and or dad are present. It's a very important developmental stage when the infant or toddler can start to have the sense that mom or dad still exist even when they've disappeared in the sense of having walked out of the room. It's very comforting. It's very soothing to a young child to start to know, to start to be able to hold in mind an image of mom, an image of dad. Because that lets them know that they still exist. It's that external object, a sense of greater permanence. And so it's a wonderful thing for a young child. It's actually very difficult if, as a young child, we don't develop a superego and or we don't develop an ego, again, because they both are two ends of the same stick. They both develop at the same time. And so it's just a little tip to be aware of the comfort, even though it's this inner voice that's always giving you a hard time, always telling you how you're screwing up, or always manipulating you, trying to shape you in a way your parents or your teachers or your boss or your even your spiritual teacher. By the way, it's okay to tell your spiritual teacher to shut up. Maybe not the literal one, though probably they could take it of anyone. But the mental image when you're having an attack of the spiritual superego, when it's telling you what's wrong with you. But again, when all of those images fall away, there's a kind of aloneness. And so it takes a little while to get familiar with, to get comfortable with things being that quiet inside and feeling that alone. And yet, it's profoundly free. There's a profound, again, sense of your own strength, sense of your own power, sense of your own capacity to decide things for yourself. Oh, yeah. Somebody just quite assume that's a... Oh, I see now. Yes, these quotes. I rule my mind. Someone quoted from the Course in Miracles a lesson, which is, I rule my mind, which I alone must rule. Yeah. And this is like a missing piece in a lot of spiritual traditions, because the superego is a very persistent, very powerful psychological structure. And so, to rule your mind and to rule your mind alone takes a certain getting used to. And it takes a certain willingness to really stand up to the superego. And without an understanding or anyone pointing you to that structure in your own mind, it's probably been running your whole life. to varying degrees, but it's always available. It's always, you know, it can always get triggered. It's good to have a way to directly address it. Now, I see someone's raised their hand, so I'm going to let go of the mic and let Kathy, I think it's Kathy, speak up. See if she has a question related to all this.
Thank you. I do. And maybe you've already said this, Nirmala. Sometimes I'm actively involved in doing some things of necessity, which today is one of those days. But the question I'm having is, so there's the regular old ego and the superego. Are you making a distinction between those two, as if, you know, beyond the level of just the recognition of, quote, myself as, you know, a person or with a personality and goes along with that and the ego involved in that, that beyond that noticing, there's something beyond even that, this thing called the superego? And if so, if there is a distinction between the ego and the superego, can you let me know what that is? Thank you. And again, I apologize if you've already covered this, but yeah. Okay, I'll let the mic go. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I kind of did speak about it, but that's fine because this is such a, like I said, it's not in a lot of spiritual traditions. It's not really part of the Eastern understanding of the spiritual journey. And so it's not that commonly known. So all of these points really can be visited over and over again, and that's great. So it's inherent in the arising of an ego, which is a mental image of yourself. That's what the ego is. It's this idea of ourself. It's not actually yourself. It's not your true nature, and it's not even kind of your authentic human self. It's this mental image that we have. And it arises with a mental image of other. It could be the superego, or it could just be your friends. It could just be the audience that you're about to step out in front of. It could be any mental image of another being, another person, that you feel like you need an egoic image to relate to. That's why we form the ego, is to have a mental image that can relate to the superego or to the other image of another person. And so you can discriminate them, you can distinguish them, and yet they aren't actually separate. They, like I said earlier, they are two ends of a single stick. It's this mental image of world and self that form together, mental image of other and self that always form together. And yet there's a difference. And in the case of the superego, the primary way you distinguish it is, first of all, it feels like it's outside of you. It feels like it is, again, attacking you, or in rare cases, complimenting you. So it's relating to you. It's addressing you. It's even if it's just a mental visual image, it can just be looking at you crosswise. You know, just kind of looking at you, like, what's the matter with you? I can't believe you did that. That was so dumb. You know, why can't you ever do anything right? So either those words are coming at you, or just the felt sense of that, the mental picture of someone looking at you as if that's what they're thinking. And so it is not the observer, because it isn't the deeper, truer self. It's a mental image of someone else. Most typically it will have a specific, in the moment it will have a specific person that is representing that inner critic. And the most common one is mom, closely followed by dad, again, depending on who was the primary caretaker. And then on top of that is are your teachers, and for the people in this group, your spiritual teachers. It's amazing how the superego will, in a sense, dress up as anyone that it thinks you will listen to and be properly chastised by. So if you have a close relationship with a spiritual teacher, you'll find that after a while you have their voice in your head criticizing you, telling you, you know, oh, you really shouldn't be watching TV, you should be. You, again, third person, that's the key, that's one of the key indicators of the superego. You should be meditating. Why can't you be more spiritual? Or you shouldn't be gossiping. You shouldn't be judging. You should be more accepting. Why can't you be more spiritual? What's the matter with you? And so again, it's not an observer. It's more like a commentator. It's more like an inner commentator. The commentator is at a sporting event that's always telling you how you're doing, and especially how you're not doing so well. And so back to Kathy's question, those two things rise simultaneously, but you can distinguish them. And because of that tendency to project strength and power and clarity and wisdom onto the end of the stick that represents the inner critic, the superego, that's actually the best end of the stick in which to undo the mental image. Because when you do, that strength and power comes back into your own body, comes back into your own being. I'll share a little story that actually illustrates this in action in a kind of striking way. This was many, many years ago. I was giving satsang in Hawaii, and it was a whole weekend, but this one particular woman, she could only come on Friday night. And she asked the question, and it was clear that what was causing her to struggle, what was keeping her kind of stuck, was leaving tomorrow for Hawaii this week. What was causing her to be stuck was her superego. And so I explained everything I'm explaining to you now about the superego and about how to defend yourself against it. And she was like, just so excited. She was like, really? Really? I can tell it to shut up? You know, like no one had ever like suggested that you could just tell that voice in your head, that annoying critical voice, to shut up and mean it and not back down until it actually does shut up. I used to joke that you could be like, there's a scene in one of the Austin Powers movies where Dr. Evil, his 15-year-old son, is criticizing him. And Dr. Evil, you know, the adult in the scene, puts his fingers in his ears and goes, na 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 na, and the son keeps trying to criticize his dad, and the dad just keeps doing that until finally the 15-year-old son gives up. He just gives up. He just throws up his hands and shuts up, you know. And so that's what you can do with your superego. Just don't get back down. Just keep whatever crazy, silly, joking, fierce way you need to be in order to get it to actually just stop criticizing. And so I told this woman, she was so excited to finally know what to do with that voice in her head. And she went home that weekend. Like I said, she couldn't make it back to any of the satsangs. And I learned all this later. It turns out she went home, and even though she couldn't come back to satsang, that whole weekend, she was all over her superego. I mean, it's like she was like loaded with a big gun, and that superego did not have a chance. It just didn't get a word in edgewise all weekend. Then Monday morning came along. And on Monday morning, she went into work. And it just so happened that she worked with this other woman. They were partners in business. And this other woman was hypercritical of the woman who had come to satsang and been practicing all week defending against her superego. In fact, it was almost like an abusive relationship. She would just really mistreat this woman repeatedly. It was just a pattern that had developed between them as partners in business. But she comes into work Monday morning. She doesn't actually tell her partner anything that she'd been doing or what she had learned or, you know, any of this information about the superego. She just started going working. And that whole day, her partner didn't criticize her once, didn't make fun of her once, did not have any critical or, you know, abusive behaviors towards this woman. So I said that when you collapse that inner projection, when you collapse that object relation, which is the two-ended stick of the image of self and the image of other, in this case the superego, when that collapses, the strength, the sense of strength, the sense of power, the sense of worth, the sense of discrimination, all those qualities come back into your being and into your body. And so without having to defend herself against her actual partner, her partner just sensed it, probably completely unconsciously, just sensed that there was something different about this woman, and that there wasn't an opening to be critical. So that's a great story to, in a sense, inspire you to give this a try, to play with this, to find out what happens. It's actually, you know, once you get going, it's actually kind of fun. It's sort of like the one place in life where you really can be like a samurai warrior and just be fierce and don't back down. And again, no one gets hurt. It's all cartoon characters in your own mind. And it's very freeing. It's very energizing. It's very liberating. It brings back the sense of your own power and strength and worth. So that, you know, it's actually rewarding in and of itself. And in a very surprising and direct way, it can also change the way that other people relate to you, because they will just sense it. So I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I've that I really want to stress. Like I said, it's a paradoxical and very opposite way of dealing with our inner mind activity, our inner mental images, than the usual kind of spiritual approach of just welcoming it. And in fact, Cheryl just typed in, that she often says to that voice, "Thanks for sharing, not feed it, just acknowledge it, move on." And I'm really glad you brought that up, because if that works, then there's no need to get all, you know, samurai warrior-ish and, you know, start chopping off people's heads. It's just that a lot of times with the superego, a gentle, welcoming, positive spiritual approach just does not work. It a lot depends on what kind of parents you had, whoever is the earliest role model for this inner mental image. If they were very critical, if they were very controlling, if they were even, in fact, abusive or mistreated you, then, you know, just saying thanks for sharing to your inner mental image, to your superego, may be about as effective as having said to your parents when you were 3 years old, "Thanks for sharing. I'm going to go back to writing on the walls with my crayons." see the question. I'll get to that in a second, because this also brought up one other thing that I wanted to say, and that is that so if the gentle, welcoming, embracing, allowing approach to your superego works, that probably just means you have had very respectful, caring parents that were not too harsh in their criticism. But, you know, all of us got criticized some, and all of us also encountered, you know, teachers and parents and police officers, and even, sad to say, some people encountered abusive and unkind spiritual teachers. And so, to whatever degree your superego has those qualities, you probably will need to meet, fight fire with fire. You will probably need to meet it, equal it, in order to get it to actually subside. But there's one other little point, and it's another thing that doesn't work with superego. You know, like I said, the welcoming approach sometimes works. Most of the time, you need to get a little bit more firm, and sometimes you need to get extremely fierce in order to get the superego to actually stop. But the one thing that pretty much never works is to reason with your superego. And the reason for that, the reason that reasoning doesn't work with the superego, is because the superego formed when you were so young. And so even though it takes on the appearance of and the voice of all these other adults and authority figures from your life, and even though it is, in a sense, its information is updated so that it can criticize you for not being spiritual enough, which of course would not mean anything to a two-year-old. However, the basic structure, the basic psychic structure is frozen at that early age. And so the superego, the inner critic, is like a two-year-old, like a three-year-old. And I don't know if you've ever tried to reason with a two-year-old, but it just doesn't work. They just don't have that capacity. It doesn't register. A classic example is a two-year-old that says, "I want ice cream." And you logically and reasonably give that young child all the reasons why they can't have ice cream. Maybe it's more like a three-year-old because they have a little bit more language. But you give it all the reasons, it's almost dinner time, you'll spoil your appetite, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And when you're done, the three-year-old says, "But I want ice cream." And that's what it's like to try to use reason with the superego. You explain all the reasons why, no, it's not a problem, I'm going to fix it, it's, everything's going to be fine, I know what to do, I'll take care of it. And the superego says, "Yeah, but that was so stupid. How could you be so stupid?" And then you give it 50 more reasons why, it's really, everything's going to be just fine, I've got it under control, everything's fine. And it says, "Yeah, you just never can do anything right. What's the matter with you?" So, that's great. Someone said their kid cried so hard he puked in the checkout line when I was trying to tell him why he could not have bubblegum. Yeah, it just doesn't work. Reason doesn't work with a young child or with the superego. And so, if the welcoming approach doesn't work, then then just turn the tables and give it hell until you are the big one. You are the powerful one. Now, someone typed in a question, and this is kind of changing the topic. I'll see if I can weave it into today's topic. But can you discuss why we are on this path in the first place and continue on it regardless of how much convincing evidence our ego presents to us that it is all meaningless? Wow, that's a challenging aspect. I wonder if it's actually the superego that's jumping in and telling you, "Oh, you're wasting your time. What's the point? You're never going to get there anyways. You're never going to awaken. You're not worthy. There's something wrong with you. You're not going to." And so it might be the superego that jumps in and tells you that it's all meaningless. That's one possibility. And of course, to a degree, our ego is, again, a response to a way of relating to the superego. So the ego may have also incorporated those messages. And so it might, there might also be a voice in your head saying, I am worthless, I will never succeed, what's the point, this is all meaningless. And so, you know, the first part of the question, why we are on this path in the first place. This is a really, really big question. I haven't found a completely satisfactory answer even for myself, but the closest thing I can come to it as an answer as to why do we go through all this? Why do we have a superego? Why do we have an ego? Why do we, in a sense, get cut off from our sense of our true nature and have to then work our way back to it? And the best I can come up with, it requires a kind of a big step back in trying our emphasize what it would actually mean if you, as consciousness, as your true nature, are infinite and eternal. What would that really mean, if to be something infinite and eternal? One aspect of it is that you would have a lot of time on your hands. Eternity is a very, very, very long time. Another aspect of it is that you would be very alone. Because anything that if you are infinite, then in a sense, wherever you go, there you are. And there's no other. There is no nothing out there to relate to because, again, you already are it. And so that, you know, that maybe sounds great, but it also, strangely enough, has a kind of inherent limitation of being kind of the same for eternity. Infinite, eternal nature is eternal and infinite. And so there's not a lot more you can say about it. And so the way that, because by the way, if you're infinite, you're also infinite in potential. And so the way that this infinite being came up with to, you could literally say, in order to pass the time, just in order to have something to do, you know, with all that free time stretching out to eternity. And also just to create some contrast and some differences and richness and strangeness in its experience, you know. It's just like after a while, when Gina, my wife, and I haven't gone anywhere, you know, we both kind of get cabin fever. Especially in the summer here, it's hot, you can't go outside a lot, you know, you can't spend a lot of time outdoors. And so we get cabin fever and we're like, oh, and we start wanting to go somewhere, do something. And usually we go to the ocean. And so this infinite being, like, has this dilemma. How do I go somewhere when I'm already there? How do I create some contrast, create some richness, some difference within this infinite, eternal being that I am? And so the way it does is it contracts a portion of itself within this infinity. It creates this illusion of a separate me, a separate self that then is temporarily no longer in touch with that infinite potential, with that infinite reality. And so it contracts into that sense of a separate self. And then, of course, you know, all kinds of things become possible that are not possible for an infinite aspect of itself. I mean, once there is a sense of a separate self, then you can go out on a date on Saturday night. It's like before that, there's no one else to go on a date with. You know, so you can dance, you can make love, you can, you know, have your heart broken, you can have all this drama, all this experience that is just not possible for an infinite being. And in fact, in a piece I wrote, in it's at the back of my book, That Is That, which, by the way, you can download for free on my website on the free ebooks tab. At the back, there's a thing called I hope it's in there. I think it is. Yes, it's a section called Beyond No Self. And it ends with a little fairy tale about being, where I tell the story about, again, this infinite eternal being. And specifically what I say is that the way it gets around its infinite nature is it uses its infinite potential to clone itself. Because once, I mean, if it's infinite, it's infinite. It can do anything, right? So it clones itself. Because once there's two or more, in this case, a huge infinite number of identical infinite eternal beings. I mean, ultimately, they're all one. But within itself, it creates this illusion of cloning itself. And then each one of those clones is free to contract. As long as one version of itself stays home as infinity and holds the universe in place while everyone else dances and plays and contracts, you know, goes into this illusion of being a separate self. Which, by the way, explains why it's such a good illusion. Because each individual, you know, human expression, it's not really a human. It's really, it's really God playing. It's like a contracted God, you know, a God that's dressing up as this other human. And so when God plays at being your annoying next door neighbor, that they do a really good job. It's like, you know, it's as if, you know, Meryl Streep or some, you know, Oscar-winning actor or actress is playing your annoying next-door neighbor. They're going to be very convincing. They're going to do a really good job of playing that role. And it's like, because it's God. It's this infinite being pretending to be a human. So, you know, that's as close as I've ever come as to why. And, you know, I think one of the processes that is invented in order to make that illusion so convincing, in order to make this all work, because, you know, in order for us to have these limited, contracted identities and experiences, it has to fool itself. You know, it has to forget that it's infinite and it's infinitely strong and infinitely powerful and infinitely free. It has to really trick itself. It has to do something that really convinces itself and makes it seem real. And one of the ways it does that is through the power of the mental images. Because again, it's God imagining the superego. It's God that imagines the ego. And of course, it starts when you're very, very young and you simply, you know, don't know better. Part of that experience of taking on the body is to have a sort of limited capacity to understand the whole process. But you have unlimited capacity to form mental images. And so that's one of the ways the mystery stacks the deck against itself so that it will get lost and have to struggle for sometimes a long, long time. This process can actually unfold, I believe, over many lifetimes. So it helps, you know, it helps to know that it's God doing it all so that you give yourself a little bit of compassion, a little bit of acceptance that, hey, you know, it's really good, and even the superego is really good at tricking you into thinking it's a real voice, into thinking that it's a real problem. And so, having the superego pointed out, and having this possibility of actually just defending yourself against the superego is a great way to start to unravel at least that portion, that aspect of the illusion. And then again, like I said, when the superego falls silent, what's left is your authentic nature, is your real self. When the superego and the ego both dissolve, then that's what's left. And it just feels just natural and freeing, and it doesn't require any effort on your part because it's just what you are. All right. Well, I took Regina up on her offer to go over, but I think some of the people that just signed on are probably looking forward to hearing what she has to say today. So I will let it go. As I said, this will be my last time doing this. The recordings will still be up for a while, and I am available for one-on-one mentoring sessions. And who knows what the future will bring in terms of possibly doing something like this or returning in some way. So thank you all, and you're all very welcome. It has been a pleasure for me also.